the word metadata means basically information about the book itself is what is the intent. It's a computer term that's gotten somewhat popular. And we're not talking about necessarily the doctrines or the teachings that are found in the book, but just the background information that might be helpful in giving us context with regard to the things that we're going to be discussing. And we want to note, first of all, that the epistle was written to the church at Rome, the brethren at Rome. Rome was, of course, a very important city in the first century. In fact, it had been important for centuries previous, and it would remain important for centuries beyond. It was the preeminent city of the world at that time. We've talked about a number of other areas of importance with regard to various cities and such. And perhaps we could even say that there were other churches in other places that were somewhat more influential and more important. Two that come to my mind would be the church in Jerusalem, which of course is the place where the gospel sounded forth first, as indicated in Acts the second chapter, and also the church at Antioch, which was the church that sent forth the Apostle Paul and Barnabas in their journeys as they went and spread the gospel throughout the world. So we can't necessarily equate the importance of the city with the importance of the church. There is not as much known about the Lord's church in Rome as there are about other churches and other congregations. The Apostle Paul actually, at this point in time, which was just about 10 years before his death, and just a few years before his incarceration in Rome, 3 years or so, he had not yet visited the city. Now, he was a Roman citizen. He was desirous of visiting the brethren in that city, but had not yet had an opportunity to do so. So we don't know as much about the church in that city. There are some references that are made in the text that we'll allude to as we go through our study. But we do want to note the makeup of the city itself, because when you look at the theme of the text, it becomes obvious that, as you might expect, the city of Rome was rather cosmopolitan. And that is, it had groups from various nations and various cultures. It was basically a mixture of various peoples. And as you might expect, that mixture that existed in the city would likewise exist in the church. Now, we noted in our study last week, as we began an introduction to this particular text, that the message of the epistle to the Romans is very similar to the message that the Apostle Paul wrote to the Galatians, the book that we just studied. There's going to be some overlap because the primary theme of both epistles is the doctrine of justification by faith. And it is set within the context of the position held by many of the Judaizers, or by the Judaizers of that time, is that we're justified by the law. And so when we're talking about the law, we're talking about the old law, the covenant that that God made with Moses and the people of Israel. And that distinction, justification by faith, apart from the works of the law, is what's the central premise of the text. So, as we talked last week in our discussion concerning the premise or the theme of the passage, it's stated in verse 17 of the first chapter. In the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, and it is written, the just shall live by faith. The just shall live by faith. Keep that kind of at the forefront of your mind as we get through this study, because there were many who believed that those who are just, they are just because they live not by faith, but by the law. And the Apostle Paul expresses that that sentiment is not true, and shows the fallacy of that belief and that position in his epistle to the Romans. The difference between the epistle to the Romans and the epistle to the Galatians is that the Apostle Paul was dealing with the error that had already invaded the churches of Galatia. And so his rebuke and admonitions were rather severe for the Galatians. They had allowed themselves to be swayed from the truth of the gospel to another gospel, which was a perversion. However, with the Romans, there's not an indication that they had been overly troubled by this particular doctrine. He simply was expressing the truth in this matter to inoculate them against the false teachers that might follow. And so the tone of the two epistles are a bit different, where one is polemic and confrontational, Galatians. Here it's more, the word is didactic. It's simply a matter of the Apostle Paul taking the time to teach the principle through that epistle. And it is something that he apparently thought to be very important because he indicated his desire to come to them, to speak to them face to face. It's something that's expressed several times in the epistle. I want to come to you. I want to tell you about these things. I want to teach these things. But I don't know when I'm going to make it or if I'm going to make it. So, in the interim, here's a letter. And that's the reason for the writing of the letter, because he was delayed in coming. He desired that they be equipped. And so he was sending the letter as a means of equipping them until such time as he would be able to come and to speak with them personally. And again, about 3 years later, under duress, no doubt, but 3 years later, he was able to see the brethren there. He was put under house arrest when he went to Rome. Of course, he was arrested in Jerusalem, had an arduous journey, ended up in Rome, was put under house arrest, but he was allowed to receive visitors at that time. No doubt the brethren became more acquainted with him on that particular occasion. But this is something a few years previous, and this letter is one that we mentioned last week is a very difficult letter. Not that, well, there's a number of reasons for its difficulty. It's difficult because the principles are profound. What the apostle is dealing with here are not the rudiments of the gospel, the first principles of the gospel. He is talking about things that are rather difficult to understand, simply because they're complex. We want to make that distinction. They're not unclear, they're complex. There are accusations made, and they would not term them accusations. I would characterize them as accusations, that there are places where the Bible is not sufficiently clear. I mean, her brethren use that phrase, areas where the Bible is not sufficiently clear. It's usually within the context of determining whether something should be a test of fellowship. God has not revealed a particular matter with sufficient clarity for us to make it a test of fellowship. I have a problem with the phraseology. I have a problem with that concept. Not everything is easy to understand. The Apostle Peter, in 2 Peter 3, deals with specifically the writings of the Apostle Paul, where he said, in some things, in such, where there are some things hard to understand and untaught and unstable people wrest them or twist them to their destruction. So they are complex and they are difficult. They're deep things. But it's not a lack of clarity. It's a matter of complexity. I try to parallel that this way with regard to mathematics. There is a level to which I think each and every one of us who are here are sufficiently able to accomplish in the realm of mathematics. I don't know, I'm not going to try to go up to what level it is, but we generally know addition and subtraction, most of us multiplication and division, although there's always, if you come across this on Facebook, if you are on Facebook or other social matters, where they've got this short mathematical equation that always has multiplication without parentheses. And everybody gets wrong answers or different answers when it says what's the correct answer because they of the different views with regard to the what you do first. Do you add first? Do you subtract first? Do you multiply first in making that? So we have some, even with simple mathematical concepts, we have some problems with those sometimes. But let's say using just simple addition, we understand that. So 5 plus 5 equals 10. But there are many of us that are completely unfamiliar with more advanced mathematics, algebra, which is not that advanced particularly, but is used in things such as calculus and other matters. And so we struggle with that because it's a deeper subject. It's more complex. It's not that the answer is, the question is fuzzy and the answer is unclear, because with regard to math, it's black and white. There is a correct answer. And the teacher, when they're teaching mathematics, they expect you to get that right answer. And if you get one that's different, it's wrong. And if you say, well, it wasn't clear, they're going to disagree with you. The equation has been set forth. What is the right answer? And so it's not a lack of clarity, but rather it is because of the complexity of the material. And then secondly, I think the second reason why the Romans can be a challenge is because since it is complex, there are a lot of people who misunderstand it. And as they have misunderstood it, their teaching has influenced the world in general. And unfortunately, the teaching may have influenced us as well. So if there is any lack of clarity, if there is any muddiness in the water, it's because of the false teaching that's muddied it, or muddled it, rather than because of any lack of clarity in regard to what the Apostle Paul is saying himself. So regardless, it's not an easy book. And I want to first of all, attest to the fact that I struggled a little bit more with regard to this handout than I have with other handouts so far. Number one, because of the length of the book, it's 16 chapters. So, for example, there's a full page more of material in these handouts than there was with regard to the Galatians, the epistles of the Galatians. But also, trying to go through and to try to, as the purpose of this is, to quantify particular passages as discussing this particular subject and go through and delineate in that regard. Paul doesn't write that way always, and so it makes it a little bit more difficult. So, having said that, we're going to use this as a guide. If there is anything in here that you believe that we're overlooking, or anything that we're not covering with sufficient clarity or fullness, then just talk with me about that, because we do want it to be understood as well as possible as we go through the material. And I think that we'll have a better understanding of Paul's writing and the nature of justification by faith, separate apart from works of the law, as a result of our study of these things. So keep in mind again that the city of Rome was a cosmopolitan city, inclusive of both Jew and Gentile. And as a result of that, much of the material is dealt with, justification by faith, in light of how that impacts the Jew and how it impacts the Gentile. And there are a number of references that are made. There are contrasts, comparisons made, the similarities between Jew and Gentile, the differences between Jew and Gentile, and how the concept or doctrine of justification by faith impacts the two of them that are contained in the book. And that's something that will be obvious. One of the first obvious examples of this is with regard to immorality. Now, I want you to think of it from the point of view of the Jewish person. Let's have a Jewish Christian. He's in the city of Rome, and he sees all of the pagan practices of the Gentiles. And he recognizes that incorporated with those pagan practices are all matters of immorality. And so it's not surprising that many Jews in that context, as they acknowledge their standing as the chosen of God, the chosen people of God. And I say Christian, but I want to reference it to the Jew first, and then we'll get into the Christian part later. But so you've got the Jews looking in the city of Rome at the Gentiles with all of their immoralities. And he looks at that, and he looks down his nose at the Gentiles because of how ungodly they are. And in fact, they are. In fact, if you look at chapter 1, beginning in verse 18, the Apostle Paul goes into some detail describing the immorality of the Gentiles. He talks about the fact that they are unrighteous and ungodly, verse 18. And the reason for that in verse 20 is because though God's innate attributes are seen in creation, They no longer retain those things in their knowledge. They change God's glory from the God He is into an image, an idol, fashioning animals and figures as being God. And as a result, because they changed the nature of God, they no longer retain God in their knowledge. They become debased in their minds, and God gives them over to such depravity. And, of course, the emphasis that he makes in this particular text is their homosexuality. That was something that was very prevalent in the Roman Empire, and especially in the cosmopolitan city of Rome, the seat of power, the seat of nobility, the seat of wealth in Rome. The decadence of Rome was very much seen in the city of Rome at this particular time. So homosexuality is specifically mentioned in this text, beginning in verse 20, about verse 24, and then going down through verse 27 or 28. Also notice in verses 29 through 31 that there is a list of various sins that we might refer to, because of the context, as sins that were characteristic of the Gentiles. They were filled with unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness. They were envious, murderous, striving, deceitful, evil-minded, whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, and unmerciful. It's a pretty good list. And so again, think about how the Jew would look at these pagans and how he would consider them. And so the Apostle Paul deals with that first, brings out all of those indiscretions of the Gentiles. And again, this is serves just as an aside, but certainly a condemnation of our society today. When you note in verse 32, they knowing the righteous judgment of God that those who practice such things are deserving of death, not only do them, but also approve of those who do them. And whenever I see that phrase, always, for me personally, what comes to my mind is the practice of abortion in our society. We too are living in very much a pagan nation, and the destructive nature, the killing of unborn children is something that is epidemic in our society. How many times have you heard someone who says, I am personally against abortion, but I support the woman's right to choose? Whenever I hear that phrase, that's the passage that immediately comes to my mind in Romans chapter 1, verse 32. They practice abortion, the killing of unborn children, and they also approve of those who kill unborn children. And when you see that kind of thing, we're talking not only about evil and the practice of evil, but the toleration of evil. It was endemic in Roman society. It's something that is very much characteristic of our nation as well. I think when you look at those verses in Romans chapter 1, some very strong parallels can be given between Rome and the United States in our time. It's something that is rather alarming. But concerning those things, an individual recognizes, verse 32, that those who practice such things are worthy of death. Now, having said that, the Jew now, he's listening or he's reading the first words of the Apostle Paul, and he's saying, you know, you're really describing exactly the way those terrible pagans are, those filthy pagans. Look at the type of individuals they are. They're ungodly, they're debased. And then in chapter 2 and verse 1, he says, therefore you are inexcusable, O man, whoever you are who judge. For in whatever you judge another, you condemn yourself, for you who judge practices the same things. Now this kind of opens the sentiment that is found through at least the first 11 chapters of Romans. You who condemn the Gentiles are condemning yourself, because just as the Gentile is guilty of sin, not necessarily the same sins, though often so. But the fact is that all have sinned. Romans, the third chapter, the wages of sin is death. Romans 6:23. And what he's saying, by looking at those individuals and being condemnatory toward them, you are judging yourself, because you're in the same boat as the Gentile. Now what is that boat that you're in? Guilty of sin, in need of God's mercy. The Gentiles guilty of sin, in need of God's mercy. The Jew says, okay, I've committed sin, but I have the law. And what his point here, throughout the entirety of the first portion of the book of Romans, is that if you place your trust and your boast in your keeping of the law, then you're in trouble. Because the law cannot justify. And so in reality, it doesn't matter whether you're a Jew or whether you're a Gentile, you're all in the same boat. You're guilty of sin. The wages of sin is death. The only escape from death is through faith in Christ Jesus. We're justified by faith and not by works of the law. And so that's the premise, again, of the entire book. The just shall live by faith. And so, really what he's saying, and again, he's not quite as harsh in his treatment of these matters as he was in his epistle to the Galatians, but he's still pretty straightforward, and it's a sobering thought, is that you have the Gentiles, they're pretty much ignorant, but you have the Jew who thinks, and perhaps that's where he has it a bit more difficult than the Gentile, because when he's presented with the gospel of Christ, the Gentile may recognize it as that saving thing, that lifesaver that he needs, whereas the Jew may not recognize that, because the Jew may think he already has a lifesaver, he already has what he needs. And the Apostle Paul has to deal with this particular topic again throughout the entirety of his writings. And in the defense of himself as an apostle and his life and ministry as a preacher of the gospel of Christ. But it's something that he does with a great deal of depth and thoroughness in this particular epistle. Continuing on, in regard to the metadata, one of the things to make note of is the time which this particular epistle was written. And this is just a note to secular history, what you're familiar with. The emperor, who was the emperor of Rome during the time that Paul wrote this epistle, was Nero. And so if you haven't taken the time to read up on the emperor Nero and the nature of Roman society during his reign, his personal cruelties and immoralities, the practice of the elite, when we're talking about the social and economic and ruling elite of Rome at that particular time, I would encourage you to do that. I mean, even just a Wikipedia search, look up Nero on Wikipedia on the internet, and just read about him and his reign. And then go back and look at Romans chapter 1, beginning in verse 18, going through the rest of the chapter. And you're going to see, described by secular historians, very much what the Apostle Paul refers to in that particular text. So Nero was not only a very evil individual and an immoral individual, but also, it's not surprising that during this time the persecution was present. In other words, Christians were being persecuted during this reign. And we're all familiar with the burning of Rome and the idea that pretty prevalent, the belief that Nero was responsible for that fire that was set in Rome and all the damage that was done, and the fact that he blamed the Christians for it. And so there was much unrest and anger for them. So it was in that particular context that the Apostle Paul wrote his epistle, and then shortly after entered the city as a prisoner. Perhaps that's why it gives us a little bit of more understanding in Philippians, the first chapter. Paul was in prison. He writes to the church in Philippi, and he said, I don't know what's going to happen to me. He said, he's under house arrest. He's really been treated fairly well. He's allowed to receive visitors, and it's become evident to the whole palace guard that his chains, are in Christ, and so he wasn't being persecuted as he possibly could be persecuted. But remember, he made his appeal to Caesar, and so there is this possibility that Paul would, while in prison in Rome, as he writes to Philippi, he's awaiting his audience before Nero. As the Caesar. And so he didn't know whether he would be killed Depart and be with Christ, which is far better. Or if you would be released, remain, which is more needful for you, as he said in Philippians chapter 1. So he didn't know exactly what would happen in his life at that particular time. That's the nature of the city at that particular time in history. I'm going to talk a little bit about the church there. Anybody have any comments, questions about the city itself and the culture? All right, then if you'll notice in the fourth bullet point, I think, nothing is revealed in the epistle that Paul wrote to the Romans, nor in the history that you look at the book of Acts, concerning how the church of Rome got there. Now, we talked about the relative significance of the church. It's Jerusalem, a very significant church. Now, is it not considered, or is it not true that the church in Rome was considered a preeminent church in, quote, Christendom, even today? Certainly so. Why is that? Well, because it is the seat of power of the Roman Catholic Church. Vatican City sits in the heart of Rome. The claim is that the Apostle Peter was the first bishop of Rome. Interestingly, if you look in the New Testament, you don't find any indication at all that Peter ever traveled to Rome. Now, as far as the construct of that idea, there are two things that come about. First of all, Jesus' conversation with Peter in Matthew chapter 16. In Matthew chapter 16, where Jesus said, "You are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church." And the idea or the view is that Jesus founded his church upon Peter. That Peter was the first vicar of Christ, the first bishop of Rome. It's a misunderstanding of that particular text. Concerning the giving of the keys to the kingdom, there is the view that exclusively the Apostle Peter was given the keys to the kingdom of heaven, again, as the vicar of Christ. And so as time went on, as a part of this view, there was erected a fiction, a legend concerning the trip that the Apostle Peter took to Rome and the fact that the Apostle Peter served as the first bishop of Rome. We could talk about all of the misconceptions with regard to that. First of all, elevating church tradition to the equivalency of Scripture. Secondly, the concept of a bishopric. That is, there being a single individual over a congregation of God's people. And a number of other things that we could talk about in that regard. There is even the belief that the bones of Peter reside in a sepulcher underneath St. Peter's Basilica in Vatican City in the middle of Rome. When you look at the New Testament, however, there is no indication that Peter was ever there. There is no revelation at all as to how the church at Rome even began, or how extensive or large that it was. We just don't know those things. We don't have information about those things. You'll notice in the fourth bullet point, we make note that it's possibly founded by some on Pentecost as they returned to their home. Remember in Acts, the second chapter, there were Jews, devout men from every nation under heaven. There was mentioned specifically in Acts, the second chapter, and in verse 10 of the text, that there were visitors from Rome, both Jews and proselytes, that were in the city of Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost as the church was first established. Now, some of them, no doubt, would have returned to Rome. And we recognize that early on in the history of the Lord's church, it seemed that the majority remained in Jerusalem until such time as the persecution arose in Jerusalem. We're told that in Acts, the 8th chapter, they scattered and went everywhere preaching the word. But it's not a surprising thing to think that some of them may have returned to Rome and established a congregation in that place. Knowing the origins of that church, when it began, who it was that was most influential in starting it, we really would only be able to speculate in that regard. And there are numerous speculations that are raised, but there is no scriptural validity to any. We simply don't know exactly. So those are all the things with regard to the metadata that I wanted to note, except for one. Anybody have any comments, questions about that material, about the book, as serving as an introduction? Yes, John.
You notice verse 7, chapter 1, Romans. Paul had a real congregation of people.
Right, right. Yeah, and that's something that becomes evident as you look not only through his epistles, all of the epistles that he writes, but also other writings that you find throughout. There are two points to be made. One is the autonomy of the local church. There's no indication ever that there was oversight beyond the environs of the local congregation. In fact, a number of times in Acts 20 and 1 Peter 5 are two examples of that. There is a specific reference of the responsibility of the bishops to oversee the flock which is among them, which would be indicative of a local congregation. Second thing, there is always, when there is a reference made to elders, the word elder, bishop, and pastor, those three terms that are used in Scripture are used interchangeably. They're not used the way the religious world uses them today, both with regard to bishop as well as with regard to the term pastor. Those terms are often used to refer to a single individual who is the head over a church or churches. Where the Bible refers to those three terms, bishop or overseer, pastor or shepherd, and elder, having reference to the age of the individual, all referencing the same office of oversight in the local congregation, that is a made up of what we'll refer to as an eldership, in the sense that there is always a plurality of men that are referenced without any exaltation of one above another. An example of this, when you talk about he didn't write to an archbishop or a bishop in a particular area having reference to a single individual with authority, in his letter to the Philippians, he again writes to the saints in Christ Jesus here in Philippi with the bishops and the deacons. His instructions were to all of the saints. There was the acknowledgement of the bishops, notice the plurality there, as well as the deacons in that place, there in verse 1. But the idea of the oversight of a single man, or the exaltation of one man above others, that's, again, an outgrowth of the Roman Catholic hierarchy. That I'm not saying that the Catholic Church started it, but rather the digression from the biblical pattern with regard to authority and autonomy is what led to the Catholic Church with its ecclesiastical hierarchy. And the interesting thing, and I don't know if y'all have done this before, but there is the Jewel Miller film strip series. There is a particular lesson on that dealing with the growth of denominationalism. And there's a chart in one of the slides of that particular study where it shows the similarity between the government of the Roman Empire and the government of the Roman Catholic Church. And where you have the emperor as the head of the Roman Empire, you have the Pope, who again is the bishop of the Roman Church, bishop of the church at Rome. And claims to be the vicar of Christ, the universal father, the head or representative of Christ on earth for all of the Roman Catholic universal church. That the hierarchy that's found in the Roman Empire, the hierarchy that's found in the Roman Catholic Church is almost identical. The names are different, but the structure is the same. And it may very well be because two things, I think. The greed of men, the greed for power, where they want to be elevated or exalted above others. And secondly, the influence of Constantinople. Is that right? The word, the name? Constantinople, the emperor of Rome? Constantine. Thank you. Constantinople is the city named after Constantine. But anyway, the emperor, who supposedly was a friend of Christianity. A Roman emperor who embraced and to a certain extent remade the government of the quote church by introducing and by basically emphasizing and encouraging this ecclesiastical structure that has led to the establishment of the Catholic Church by the 6th century, 7th century. in his earlier sense with regard to its reality. So, again, that kind of thing isn't found in this epistle. That kind of thing is not found in the New Testament, but it's certainly something that you can see its gradual development as you look at secular records of the history of the apostasy of the Lord's Church through those years. The only other thing I wanted to add with regard to the metadata is what we mentioned in our study very quickly last week, that Paul seldom wrote out his own epistles. At least the indication seems to be that it was difficult for Paul to actually scribe his own epistles. And he would allow another to do it for him. In this particular case, in Romans chapter 16 and verse 22, there is a salutation at the end of the letter that is made by Tertius in verse 22. He said, "I, Tertius," so he's identifying himself. Now we recognize the Apostle Paul wrote the epistle, but Tertius scribed it. He said, "I, Tertius, who wrote this epistle, greet you in the Lord." And so we just wanted to make note of that. We touched upon that, I think, a little bit in our study last week, so we won't emphasize it any further. Okay, any questions, comments about the basic introductory material with regard to the book of Romans? All right, good. We're making good progress then. I will, again, just to note it before we go on, ask you to look at on the front page of the material the outline of the book, just for one specific purpose. The book consists of two basic sections. So we have in Roman numeral 1 the introduction, which is not one of the major sections. And then 4, 5, and 6, we have final greetings. He talks about his itinerary, he gives some greetings, and then he gives his benediction to God and the end or salutations in Roman numerals 4, 5, and 6. Now these are, they contain some important teaching, these things that we'll discuss, but they don't make up the body of Paul's epistle. So we'll address those kinds of things, but we're going to emphasize two major sections of the epistle. The first one is found in chapter 1 and verse 18, where we noted again the beginning of this description of the pagan sins, and goes down through the end of the 11th chapter. And that is where he does his teaching on the subject of justification by faith, separate from works of law. We're going to look at that. That's where the majority of the tough stuff is. That's going to make up the majority of our study and the time that we spend. Concept of justification by faith that's found in those 10 chapters. In chapters 12 through midway through the 15th chapter, there is what we might refer to as a practical application of the concept of justification by faith. In other words, since we're justified by faith, how should we act? Now, this is a very important thing that we need to recognize. There's allusion to it earlier in the epistle, Romans chapter 6, for example. Should we continue to sin that grace may abound? Absolutely not, or certainly not, Romans 6, 1. So there are references to it previous. But he's gone through, he's argued it, he's established his premise that we're justified by faith. Now, what should we as Christians do in response to that truth? And so he says, beginning in Romans 12, 1 and 2, not to conform yourselves to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, to present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. So this concept of being transformed and living a life that is different from the one that you lived before is the application to the arguments of the first 10 chapters, or 11 chapters. In addition to that, in the remainder, beginning in chapter 12, verse 3 through 15, 13, there are some specific exhortations that are given. We talked about some of them on Sunday evening, and we will go into more detail in our study in that matter. So that's basically the construct of the book, and we want to make note of those two major divisions that are in the book. Okay, remind you again of the chapter synopses and the suggested memory work that are found there. I would again like you, if you did not do it this week, please, before we begin the bulk of the study, get into the text next week, read the book of Romans. Understand as you read through it that you're not going to, well, you might. You may be really good. You may understand every single aspect of that entire book in the first reading. If you do, and you're a man, then raise your hand next week and we'll switch places and I'll sit down and let you teach. But otherwise, understand that some of this is going to be difficult. So don't get overly bogged down in the difficult aspects of it. Read the book several times, looking at the outline to familiarize yourself with the divisions of the book and how it flows. Read the chapter synopses as a summary for each chapter. Familiarize yourself with it that way. And I think that will really help you as we get into our discussion of the material at hand. We're going to start in our study next week with the first bullet under the doctrinal considerations. There are a number of places, chapter 1, 3 through 4, 6 through 7, as well as chapter 5, verses 6 through 11, where the gospel is stated in a concise manner. We want to look at the gospel as it is stated in those places. And then, as I said before, this isn't necessarily the best way of doing it in the covering, but as I like the way I prepared the material. I think it's helpful to prepare it that way. But as far as going through the handout, it becomes troublesome because there would be so much overlapping and going back and forth if you just went through my bullet through. So what I'm going to be doing is combining in our actual study. I'll try to let you know how to do it. But the difficult passages, the doctrinal considerations, and the questions to consider, all of those things are going to be kind of tied in together and interspersed. So you might want to just note that chronologically from the first of the book to the end of the book. We're going to be kind of going down through that material in that manner. Then at the end of that study, we'll double back and look at some of the practical things. And that's the way we're going to cover that material. So that's what we've done again with others, but it's going to be a little bit more difficult to keep it straight in our minds this time. So I would encourage you to keep that in mind. All right, appreciate very much everyone's kind of attention. We'll get into the text in our discussion next week.